Yes, yes, this is Raoul Reynolds. This is the Step Up Podcast. Austerity. Everybody's talking about it, reporting it, supporting it, fighting it, living through it. All over Europe since the financial crash of 2007, economic policies of austerity have been used and abused, and many are bemused as to exactly why. This podcast is going to be all about austerity. What is it? What are its effects? Why do we employ it? And what are the alternatives? And because I'm just an ignorant, economically illiterate pleb who just runs around on stage like a headless chicken squawking for a living, I've drafted in some help for today's subject. One of the best things about being in a band, I think, is the amount of people you get to meet, the amount of people you're able to interact with, share ideas with, converse with. And I'm talking about people from all different walks of life, different backgrounds and cultures, people coming from different specialities. So I reached out on Twitter and the following chaps kindly gave up some of their time to have a good old chinwag about economics. I spoke to Ben Marshall, an investment researcher with a master's degree in political economy from the London School of Economics. I spoke to Ross Baxter, a political writer for Whippersnapper, and Ben Pringle, who studies economics at the University of Manchester and is a member of the Post-Crash Economics Society. So being primarily a podcast about economics, there's obviously going to be a lot of jargon and economic lingo used, as there always is in this subject, so much of it. Every time there's a term that perhaps the general public wouldn't understand, you're going to hear this noise.
Bollocks!
And one of us will endeavour to explain what that term means. So hopefully this will be understandable for all.
You're listening to the Step Up Podcast.
So to begin with, what is austerity? Tom, at generic shit name on Twitter, says, can we get literally a deep explanation of what it actually means? It's said so often, and I think people just assume a definition. The word itself comes from the Greek word osteros, meaning bitter or harsh in taste. Today it means to have very little comforts or luxuries, to be stern, to be frugal, to be a stingy bastard, basically, to cut back on one's expenditure, to live a life of plainness and simplicity. But what does it mean in the political world? Austerity measures are generally unpopular because they tend to lower the quantity and quality of services and benefits provided by the government. How do they do that? Why do they do that? What is austerity? Here's, first of all, my boy Ben Marshall.
So you're completely right. If you talk about austere living, what you're talking as a stripped back lifestyle, not much spending, certainly no spending beyond your means. When you talk about it in economic terms, what you're talking about is reducing government borrowing. And so the way that you do that is either by hiking up taxes or cutting down spending, which the British government's employed both.
George Osborne is the Chancellor of the Exchequer for the current Conservative government. And here's Ben Pringle.
So obviously George Osborne has set a period of time to try and get the government deficit down, which is the difference between what the government takes in taxes, in, well, its revenue, and what the government spends. Basically, over time, he's cutting the deficit by cutting departments' funding.
When you talk about austerity, it actually just means reducing what you're spending at the moment. So if we said that, or reducing what you're borrowing at the moment. So if we said the government was borrowing 20% in 2008, austerity measures means it could be borrowing 19% in 2009. And it's a really technical difference, but it's quite a big difference because it significantly changes how much you're spending.
So austerity is reducing how much money a government borrows, meaning it has less money to spend, and therefore has to cut funding for government services. Now, we hear a lot about this, the dreaded cuts, especially in Europe since the crash. But what actually gets cut? I asked Ben, what is government spending normally on?
Spending is any infrastructure investment. It's whatever they collect in taxes, and then anything which they choose to borrow. that they put out in any manner whatsoever. So the one which is repeated most often in the press is benefits, and that can mean anything from unemployment and disability allowances. But it also is vastly taken up by pension money. But then beyond that, government spending also includes schools, it includes the NHS, it includes the roads, the police force, firefighters. I mean, almost any industry that you think of as being government run is what we're talking about when we're talking about government spending.
So on the face of it, the outcome of austerity is that list of essential public services being cut. Most recently in the UK, we've seen disability benefits cut, we've seen the police force cut, we've seen the NHS cut. This is why it appears to me that disregarding the economics, being anti-austerity is the humane and sane position to take. We want a strong, safe, healthy society, so we need these public services. But it's becoming more and more apparent that even economically speaking, being anti-austerity is the rational position. So why is austerity enforced? It appears from what we've talked about so far that it's to reduce spending and therefore reduce borrowing, which can in turn slowly reduce a country's debt. Now, nothing highlights the peculiar nature of our current economic system more than debt. Just have a gander at nationaldebtclocks.org and watch world debt or the debt of individual countries rise and rise by the second. When a country's debt begins to surge past certain points, folk get nervous and different economic policies are enforced. So I asked the lads, on the face of it, austerity measures are simple and seem quite intuitive. They are to reduce the country's debt, right?
That would be a Tory-friendly way of putting it.
Ross Baxter.
Yeah, I mean, it would depend on who you ask, sort of what they believe austerity is for. Those who are being hit by it are probably more likely to say, you know, it is politically motivated. But certainly those controlling it and running it and making these decisions would say, yeah, you know, it's about bringing down that level of borrowing, making sure we're not paying too much in interest on the existing debts we've already got, as well as not piling stuff on top of that at the same time.
Ben Pringle.
The ideology is that if we have smaller government finances, it'll mean that in the future will be in a better position, but austerity is scientifically unproven. Like, you can look at countries like Greece, Portugal, Spain, who have had austerity as well. They're obviously not doing very well and doing a lot worse than us. Basically, they've had harder measures than us and are doing worse.
Ben Marshall.
What the goal of austerity is really quite a complex issue because when the financial crisis struck in 2008, the initial response was to implement a huge macroeconomic stimulus, whereby the government borrowed tons of money and injected it straight back into the economy. What happened then was everyone started to panic about the levels of borrowing that was happening. It was the sort of thing you don't see in peacetime. It's what you get during a wartime economy. And people panicked, thinking that was going to hurt in the future when they would have to start cutting back. So what they did immediately when the Tories and the Lib Dems came in as a coalition was slash that, implement really harsh austerity. Now, as to whether it has political motivations or not is obviously highly disputable. But if you look at, say, the US, which didn't ease it off, they carried on having a stimulus and their economy grew faster. So what you might draw as a conclusion from that is that the actual aim of austerity was political rather than economical.
Political rather than economical means it was a strategy that was used to achieve an ideological outcome. So, for instance, the Conservatives in the UK don't really support the welfare state. The welfare state is the system that protects the health and well-being of the country's citizens, especially those in financial or social need. So, for example, we're talking about benefits, safety nets for the unemployed, the poor, the vulnerable. The Conservatives see austerity as a great excuse to shrink that welfare state. Austerity wasn't enforced as a rational strategy, as seemingly the evidence doesn't really support it. It was actually put forward to achieve a more divided society, one that doesn't spend money looking after the welfare of the unlucky or the unprivileged. At FelixTY95 on Twitter asks, "What do you think George Osborne's long-term economic plan actually is? Like, what's his vision?
Well, I think George Osborne's big economic plan is to reduce the state and to have the private sector doing a lot of what the state used to do. I think that's the big idea, that he has friends who, well, not friends, he has allies in the private sector who, I think a lot of this goes back to the way party donations work. You've got the Labour Party and the Conservatives, and a lot of the leadership candidates for, say, the Mayor of London and for the Labour leadership, apart from Corbyn, who have got a lot of backers who are very rich people from very select areas of the economy. Say if I donated money to you, even if you didn't have any intention to, you'd probably in the back of your head think, oh, well, I'll have to do something for so-and-so, because that's how it works.
So George Osborne wants an ideological outcome. He wants to underfund the social services that protect us all, and he wants to sell them off to private companies. He wants to take them out of control of the public for the profit of the few. So economic growth wasn't achieved in the UK through austerity, but in the US, where they continued borrowing and didn't implement austerity, they saw their economy grow rather well. So how do we know how bad a country's debt is and how quickly its debt is rising? Well, it's measured by, and here comes the siren, its debt to GDP ratio.
Bollocks.
GDP is gross domestic produce. It's the total output of the nation. So when you talk about debt, you're talking about what you're borrowing in total of your GDP. So if you're borrowing 200% of the GDP, your debt is twice your country's output for that year. Obviously, when people talk about austerity and balancing the books, they're talking about borrowing an amount no greater than what it is the countries produce. But realistically, that's not something that any developed country is going to want to do, because it's by borrowing that you stimulate growth.
We've seen many examples through history of how borrowing, the opposite from austerity, achieves growth. One example of a scary debt to GDP ratio in the UK was in the 1940s. The incoming Labour government inherited a whopping 200% debt to GDP ratio due to the borrowing of the previous government during the Second World War. No surprise there, war costs a shit ton of money. And to give you some perspective, today's debt to GDP ratio is currently around 80%. But in the 1940s and 50s, the Labour government did what is fundamentally the complete opposite to what the Tory government is doing now. They borrowed and they invested. They created the welfare state, they created the NHS, they created full employment and kickstarted economic growth, therefore managing to steadily reduce the debt to GDP ratio. I asked the lads, with this gleaming example of investing to kickstart growth, why is there so much airtime and respect given to the Tory plan of austerity?
That possibly sort of comes back down to looking at the politics of it. Obviously, at the time, after the war, we had a Labour government with big figures in it that wanted to really drive the welfare state and help people and create things like the NHS. The complete opposite is the case now. We've got a Tory government who are, more interested in cutting that back down. They've got no real desire to sort of take that anywhere or push it, or it seems to, help the average person. So I think that does sort of bring it back down to us talking about it being a political motivator rather than a complete economic one.
The World War II example is a good example, but it's a bit complex because you're talking about coming out of a war economy. What's perhaps more pertinent is if you look at FDR.
FDR is, of course, short for, it's the initials of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the president who managed to surf America successfully through the Great Depression.
He set up all the alphabet agencies, implemented huge government stimulus, and that's perhaps the most successful turnaround of an economy from recession/depression that there has ever been. What's interesting is that was kind of the precursor to Keynesian economics, which is when you spend during recession and save during growth. Now, that was the prevailing theory up until the 70s, which got then, during the time of Thatcher, replaced by neoliberal ideas and monetarist ideas, which is what we're still feeling now. And for whatever reason, despite seemingly having worked in the past, it's fallen out of fashion. And so we get austerity politics. However, you are seeing a resurgence of Keynesianism. People like Paul Krugman are really keen to champion it because it's tried and tested in history, and austerity seemingly has been a failure.
I definitely wanted to touch on Keynesian economics, as with my limited knowledge, this seems to be the most sensible way of doing things. Keynes said very clearly, the boom, not the slump, is the best time for austerity. Here's Ben Marshall again giving us some background and detail on Keynes.
John Maynard Keynes is pretty much the most famous British economist aside from Adam Smith. He came up with a lot of ideas about macroeconomics and the economic policies of government. And what he's kind of famous for is he really lobbied and championed the idea that governments should save during periods of growth, and then during periods of slowdown, they should spend so as to stimulate the economy. That's kind of the antithesis to austerity politics. And as I said, it fell out of fashion in the 1970s when neoliberal ideas were very much at the forefront, and it was believed that the government shouldn't take an active role in the economy.
One of the things that Keynes was quite big on is that when you invest money, there's a multiplier. So if the government invests money in, say, the northeast of England, that creates jobs, it creates more infrastructure, you'll have people be able to get to places faster, etc. So say for every pound they invest, £4 going to be added to the economy. That's the sort of the way that works. But obviously at the minute, with there being little investment, no investment, that money's just going out the economy, and you've got places, especially in the north of England, which are just like on the knees, so to speak.
Government borrowing and spending is a bit like central heating in your house. If it's cold out, i.e. we're in a recession, a downturn, a slump, turn the heating on. That's government spending. Austerity is a bit like thinking, it's cold out, but we ain't going to turn the heating on. We're going to open the windows and doors and let you fuckers freeze. So not only by cutting during a slump are we using austerity at the wrong time, according to Keynesy Boy, but it seems to only be producing further unemployment, increasing the debt, and certainly isn't stimulating the economy.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of unemployment, we've definitely seen since the recession, really, back 2008, you know, unemployment really started to rack it up. In the past couple of years, we have seen a gradual decrease, and it's something every time it happens, you'll have, you know, the Tory government out shouting about it and how good it is that unemployment's dropping. But what they're not recognising is a much bigger issue of underemployment. It's about 1 in 10 workers, about 3 million people want more hours. They want to be able to work more. But a lot of these new jobs that are being created, part-time or casual hours, zero-hour contracts. There's no security for people to know what they're doing week in, week out. That's something that's never really reported on that side of things. They just shout about how unemployment is gradually coming down.
The other side of austerity politics regarding employment is that it has an adverse effect on wages, because it freezes wage inflation, essentially, because you're not having all the additional surplus money injected into the economy. So you're not seeing wage growth grow appropriately.
Well, obviously, the big one recently has been the Department for Work and Pensions, the sort of deaths that have been connected to people not being given their benefits and being having their benefits suspended. But you've got that there, which is terrible, which that is the most vulnerable people in society. And when you've got, we're a developed country, we're a very rich country in respect to many different countries in the world, and yet you've got things like that going on. And then obviously you've got the bigger picture, which is in the media there isn't a lot on the effects to the green sector. So you've got things like solar energy subsidies, which are just cut, being completely cut. And then you've got, on the other hand, fracking being put forward. We've got to remember as well, it's a finite planet, and you can't go on forever using fossil fuels forever. We've got to, at some point, we've got to invest in the green sector.
So austerity can cause unemployment, underemployment, the slowing of the growth of your wages. It cuts vital public services, vital disability allowances, out-of-work allowances. Now, with all of that in mind, here's a great question from Jackson Pooler on Twitter. What brings some people that rely on social programmes, i.e. the ones being cut by the Tories right now, to come to the conclusion that austerity is the only answer? So what makes people agree that austerity is the right thing to do?
If I was to say to you, what's the difference between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party? Do you have an idea of what the choice is then?
Really? One is slightly better for a poor person and one is not.
Okay, which one's slightly better for the for poor people?
Conservative.
Wow.
I think the problem is, not only is there a lot of Conservative-friendly press, i.e. newspapers owned by rich and powerful Tories, but the Conservatives use such simplistic and easy-to-understand language. Their rhetoric, their explanations of the situation are lucid and believable, and therefore their policies remain dominant. For instance, they'll use seemingly legitimate and uncomplicated metaphors, like comparing the economy to a responsible household. If a household, or say family, has debt, they have to stop spending so much. On the face of it, that seems like a totally valid analogy. But in fact, when you're talking about an economy, it's complete and utter bollocks.
Straight away when the Conservatives got in 2010, the word in their use was stuff like, oh, we're going to go bankrupt. We're going to be the next Greece, we can't spend what we haven't got, etc. But obviously, things like that, especially the household where it's we're going to go bankrupt, that's absolute drivel. I mean, a government is completely different to a household. So when the Conservatives say the government could go bankrupt, I mean, we've got our own central bank. I mean, you can't compare the UK to Greece because Greece is in a monetary union. In the euro, whereas the UK has their own sovereignty. Even if we were put under in the sort of similar situation that Greece would be in a position to deal with it a lot better than Greece has been able to, because they haven't got control over their money through the central bank.
When you talk about balancing your budget like a household, it's nonsense. The state is nothing like a home. The state can print its own money. Whilst the central bank is independent, it can be lent on heavily by government, and at the end of the day, it's going to do what's in the best interest of the nation. So that means if you are running a massive surplus, you can do what the central bank ended up doing, which is quantitative easing, which by any other term is printing money, which then makes additional debt. Whilst it's not necessarily a great thing, you don't want it to get out of hand, it's not really an issue. Whilst the Tories have been happy to hammer home that spending was a terrible thing, in actual reality, it wasn't a terrible thing.
After losing to the coalition, and we're seeing it more now as well, the Labour Party is far too willing to accept Tory rhetoric that they caused the economic crisis. They don't ever really sort of want to come out and say that completely outright, but you know, you'll see them apologising for it. And you know, they really should be doing a lot more to actually stand up against it and go, no, you're completely wrong, rather than bowing down to it, because that just reinforces every single thing that the Tories are saying. And I think you often find as well that it depends entirely on the thing, because there are some things that the Tories are more than happy to spend on. I mean, we just saw the other day £500 million going to Fastlane, to the nuclear base up in Scotland. You know, you see something like that and you sit there thinking, you've just spent all this time telling us we've got no money, and then suddenly you've got £500 million going to a nuclear weapons base. What's going on there?
There's a similar example recently too, where they decided to cut inheritance tax, which is essentially a tax break for the rich. And that really has been the classic Tory line: we've spent too much. We have to tighten our belts, balance the books, live within our means. They've done a great job of drumming those simple little phrases into the whole country's psyche. But hold on, what's the bulk of this overspending been on? The financial crisis, bailing out the banks. Now, effectively, bailing out the banks is taking private debt, i.e. the debt that banks got themselves into through ruthless, irresponsible banking methods, and making that debt public, i.e. forcing the state to pay for it. This is where the phrase you may have heard, too big to fail, is interesting. The truth is the banks have such a stranglehold on our society. They know if they were to fail, there would be utter chaos and huge strife. Therefore, they can afford to be reckless. They can afford to act with negligence and carelessness and only think about profit because they know they are effectively protected. And now we, the public, are having to pay for systematically irresponsible banking methods. So the biggest contributor to our debt has been the cost of saving the bankers' arses. It's like the bankers had a massive 3-day bender, a raucous, hedonistic private party, but we, the public, got the hangover. So I asked the lads, is it an oversimplification to say that austerity is the poor paying for the mistakes of the rich?
I think it's a completely fair point. I mean, there's been absolutely no repercussions from the financial crash, really, for the financial sector. They've had a few sort of leverage limitations, but apart from that, the same thing could happen again in the future. And I mean, you had, at least after the crash in America in the 1920s, at least, and in the UK, at least you had regulation that come in after that at least limited the sort of role that the financial sector had and the sort of limitations that were on them. Whereas after 2008, there's been very little done by the government, whereas they should have been looking to do a lot more to limit the sort of influence that the financial sector could have. A lot of people do hate that sort of, the rich F up and the poor people pay for it, but it is the case, really. There's been, I mean, you've got quantitativism, which pushed up the price of assets, which made rich people more money. It didn't have any effect on ordinary people in the UK. Obviously, austerity, which is killing people in certain parts of the UK and is having people live in really, really horrible conditions. And then you've got, at the same time, banks making profits again and having big bonuses. So you can't have capitalism without equality. And at the minute, you're going towards more and more inequality.
I would almost go beyond that. I would argue that austerity is unrelated to the financial crash. I would say austerity is a purely political measure meant to target the poor. It's simply about reducing the welfare state. As I mentioned earlier, the US carried on with a stimulus rather than austerity, and it was the fastest growing developed economy. Therefore, that would have been the rational response. So why are we doing austerity? It's nothing to do with the financial crash or balancing the books. It's about cutting the state down to size and selling off the public assets.
Selling off public assets means taking services out of the ownership of the state and selling them to private companies to profit off. So recently in the UK, we've seen this happen to the Royal Mail Service as well as our rail services. Austerity seems to enable and even ramp up the selling of these services under more devious routes. This is what the economist Ross Ashcroft calls backdoor privatisation. And this is what we've seen happen to the NHS over the last few years. Backdoor privatisation is where you starve a public asset of funding, so i.e. cutting the NHS. And then you say, look, it isn't working, everyone. We're going to have to sell it to the private sector. It's kind of like being picked for your school football team and a bully who isn't quite as good as you gets picked for the subs bench. He takes a good kick at your shins when the ref isn't looking. Then he shouts, oh, look, ref, he can't play, he's injured, as you hobble around. The ref then insists you sit the rest of the game out and the bully boy gets brought on to replace you with a smug grin. Okay, a stretch of a metaphor there, but I think it does the job. What is privatisation for then? Is there any reason for the public to want privatisation?
Privatisation, it sounds very emotional, but it's done entirely for the benefit of the people who are going to end up owning that item. So, I mean, for example, the privatisation of the rail network, you know, that was never really going to provide any real massive benefit to anyone other than shareholders, the people who own it. Same with Royal Mail, you know, being sold off a value of less than it was actually worth. It was only ever the shareholders that were going to benefit from that. You know, the taxpayer doesn't benefit, the people don't really benefit, you know, they're getting the same sort of service usually.
Yeah, beyond that, I would highlight the case of RBS.
Royal Bank of Scotland.
that couldn't be done more clearly to benefit the wealthy classes. The sale of shares wasn't available to the average person. If it were, I would have bought RBS shares because I think they were undervalued. But that option wasn't given to me. It was given to high net worth institutions.
It's becoming more and more apparent that we privatise profits, i.e. infrastructure like National Rail, Royal Mail and the NHS, and we nationalise or make public the losses, i.e. bailing out the banks and keeping those specific NHS treatments that are non-profitable on the NHS.
There are examples of NHS contracts that got privatised, that got given to certain parts of the private sector with specific clauses in them that said if the private company was going to make a loss, the government would buy it back off them. They would buy them out of the contract and carry on running it themselves at a loss. And when you're going into things, you know, already saying that, it becomes very, very clear that it's to the private sector, it's only about the money because they've specifically put that thing in place to cover them so that they cannot make a loss from it. Because if they do, the government just takes it straight back again.
Here you are, Jenny. Here's the lemons and the soda water you need for your little lemonade stand that you're making today in the street. But just so you know, if you don't make a profit today, here's the receipt for the lemons and the soda water. I'll be needing that £5 back regardless. Recently, on both sides of the Atlantic, we've seen a resurgence of social values and progressive ideas regarding politics and the economy. We've seen the meteoric rise of politicians like Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders. They've been revitalising what seemed to be a very stale political atmosphere recently. And they've been galvanising the left. There's now huge enthusiasm from the youth and the disenfranchised. We're also seeing the rise of genuine economic alternatives and ideas. Positive money, people's quantitative easing, local currencies, cryptocurrencies. The future's beginning to look a little brighter.
Well, I mean, I think what's really important to state when you're talking about a lot of Jeremy Corbyn's policies are they're not actually that left wing. Mm. What's happened is the debate has just been shifted so far to the right that centrist policies now seem extreme. People's quantitative easing is not a particularly left wing policy. Ben Bernanke, who was the chairman of the US Federal Reserve for 2 years, he actually fully endorsed this idea. He called it helicopter money, where he just suggested dropping money from helicopters as a way of putting money directly into consumer hands and increasing spending. It's not radical.
Now, this is a really interesting point and something the journalist Owen Jones talks about. The concept of the Overton window. This window basically frames the accepted parameters of debate. Every opinion or political position within the framework is deemed normal, and every idea outside of it is deemed radical, loony, crazy. Now, this window of prevailing orthodox ideas can be moved, like shifting the goalposts. And at the moment, as Ben says, regarding economic policy, it's been moved further to the right. So ideas like Jeremy Corbyn's quantitative easing are reported as the ideas of a far-left Trotskyist fruitcake. So the question is, how has this conversation been pushed so far to the right?
Honestly, the reason the debate's been able to be shifted so far to the right is because the debate is funded and owned by the wealthiest in society. You want to look at every big media organisation, bar the BBC. It is owned by someone very wealthy, particularly if we're talking about newspapers. You want to look at every major think tank that's dictating the policies and agendas of governments. They are funded by wealthy individuals. You don't get left-wing think tanks to the extent that you get right-wing ones. And because of this, the debate has been pushed further and further to the right.
So with that amount of money and power behind the right's policies, the left, as we're seeing now, seems to rely solely on people power. At Stantonio on Twitter says, how do we go about getting the economists who actually understand the problems with austerity into the political picture?
That's a very interesting question, because if you look at the biggest economists in the world, the most famous economists in the world, you're talking your Thomas Piketty's, your Paul Krugman's, they're actually spouting the same things that we've been discussing this evening. Similarly, if you look at the biggest financial institution in the world, the International Monetary Fund, it disapproves of austerity. I mean, economists have already moved further to the left than the politicians have, which really makes you wonder, why are we going down this road?
40 leading economists
including former advisor to Bank of England, made public their support for Jeremy Corbyn's policies. So as we've just covered, we are seeing that happen more and more often, and people sort of speaking up and going, actually, this is the way forward.
Public services are everything that makes society civilised. Our schools and universities, our emergency services and our National Health Service, our benefits and other safety nets for the poor and for the vulnerable. Austerity means cuts to these vital public services. The cutting is supposed to achieve growth, but this is bullshit. It increases debt, increases unemployment, and it inhibits people getting out of poverty. It is the opposite policies to that of austerity, that of government spending that stimulates economic growth, job creation, and social mobility. Austerity creates a more unequal and therefore dangerous society, and that hurts us all. Whether rich or poor, left or right, liberal or conservative, austerity is anorexia for our economy, and it must end. Big up for listening. This has been the Step Up Podcast. As always, get in touch at Raoul Reynolds on Twitter. Let me know your thoughts.